Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
Hey, Robert, how are you today?
Today, Russell, I am feeling jolly, which is a word that I associate with today's guest.
Me too.
And I have always had a strange connection to him because he is the master of a good knit. He loves like jumpers and cardigans occasionally that are like hand knitted, which I have then bought often because he's worn them. Mm-hmm. And he's a bit of a kind of icon to me. Because
I think
whenever
sometimes
he puts
I've said to you sometimes, wasn't he wearing that? I won't say the name yet. Wasn't our guest wearing that? And you're like, yes, well, you know, I actually had it on order first. But he managed to get access to it first. But I actually had it on order first.
There was one time about 4 years ago, maybe longer actually, probably 8 years ago now, when I went to Prada and they were doing this kind of collection with like sunsets and things like knitted into the jumpers. And we went into the changing room to try this jumper on. And they wouldn't give me that collection because it had just come out or something. And he was in there getting changed. And I was so jealous. And I was like, how come he gets it? And they were like, he's a fashion journalist. He's a writer. He's someone really important. And I was just like this lowly sort of gallery assistant or something. So was not worthy of the Prada. But anyway, ever since then, I have followed his knitwear. And I'm a big fan.
Hated him.
But today, we are talking to him, not as a knitwear lover, but as a published author of a wonderful new book called What Artists Wear, which is coming out on Penguin, and it has the classic kind of Penguin logo on the sleeve, and I'm in love with this book. And we've actually finally been sent, we were sent an early copy, but we've been sent the finished actual copy that's going into the shops, and it is truly extraordinary. So everybody get out and buy this book as soon as you hear this show. And I think also it made me, I don't know, it's just really exciting to see books about art, you know, coming out right now. You know, ours is obviously out, but Jennifer Higgy's had her amazing book come out, and it's just, I don't know, it feels like a good time for publishing. So good times. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Charlie Porter.
Hello, Russell, hello, Rob.
The funniest thing is, Charlie, you actually said you were feeling jolly, and I'd already tried that word.
I feel like I should, obviously we're doing this remotely, I feel like I should go upstairs to where my clothes are and change jumper every few minutes. I feel terrible about that Prada thing. I think we were doing pre-orders or something?
Something like that,
some sort of pre-order thing. So I don't think I actually got it that day. I think I was trying it on. I'm so sorry.
It was like the Holy Grail, though. It was all very hush-hush and like, I don't think we were meant to see
some
you trying
secret,
it on. Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, secret thingy.
It's a very Devil Wears Prada moment. I love it.
Yeah, this is knit, but it's a different sort of knit. It's like I'm wearing a Wales Bonner. It's like a kind of very crisp knit. Do you spend most of the time talking about what people are wearing on the program? I think it's apt. Talk art rather than...
But it's apt to talk to you.
What person...
When you've written a book...
What the person is wearing.
When you've written a book called What Artists Wear, it feels very apt to be talking about what you're wearing right now.
It is cold enough to be wearing a big, thick sweater, so yeah.
And also...
I've actually got a blanket here ready if I get chilly, so yeah, I'm like...
Cashmere.
That's actually another thing I learned about from you is blankets, because you posted from Milan... Marnie's show when Francesco Rizzo joined, and you were like, blankets! And blankets. They had like blankets on the catwalk.
Blankets. It's actually, no, it's a Craig Green, can you see? It's a Craig Green kind of quilted, it was a collection that was about kids who were, I think, at kind of a boarding school or something, and they kind of dragged blankets behind them on the catwalk.
So good.
And that's one of them. So
love that.
Sounds very jolly.
It's actually taking me back to your show that you curated at the V&A, or they had like a presentation of some of your clothes, or
right? Yeah, I've donated. I've been donating clothes to the V&A for a few years now, and there is some of them are on display there in a cabinet.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's very weird to suddenly see a cabinet of things I've worn.
But what I love about that, you've said that you've donated 82 items to the V&A, and
yeah.
You said that once a garment enters the collection, it cannot be cleaned.
Cannot be cleaned. And I did not know that. No one told me that. And so the state of some of the things, I just presumed they'd go for, it's like getting a cheap dry cleaner or something. I just presumed that they'd be like looked after in a way that I never could. But they had an exhibition of underwear at the V&A a few years ago. And it was the first time anything I donated had been put on display. And it was a tracksuit by Sibling, who were a London brand.
Yes.
From Sid and Joe and Cosette.
Loved that, and I'm a big fan of Cosette. She's an icon to me.
Yeah, she's amazing. And it was a knit that depicted the Hackney riots of 2013 and a toile de jouy, one of those words that I write down but don't know how to pronounce, toile de jouy kind of pattern.
What's that pattern like? What does that look like?
It's a kind of, I think it's like a white background with like a blue kind of drawn, quite sort of, not chintzes, flowers, isn't it? I'm not quite sure, but it's like kind of like a toile de jouy.
Oh, okay, right, you've got it.
You know,
toile de jouy. Yeah.
Do you like that fashion writer's trick of just saying it often?
Sounds believable.
Exactly. Toile de jouy, and so I went to see the display, and I was like, why is that mannequin's arms folded? And then I went and looked in closer, and it's like, oh. God, there's a massive egg stain right in the middle of this clothes, and they've had to put the mannequin with the arms like that. And they actually didn't realise when they took the photo for the postcard. I think it's a postcard you can still buy in the V&A shop. And if you zoom in really, really close, you can see this egg stain on my.
And that's
V&A.
And do you remember dropping the egg on that T-shirt?
I wish my memory was that. precise.
That detail.
No.
But do you feel really proud about that? Is that not like incredible for you? And
egg stains
on all your clothes.
But, egg stains of V&A.
Also, like knowing about Zoie de Gie, right. And also having work in the V&A.
It's magic. It's really magic. But the reason for it was that the time I've spent writing about fashion has coincided with menswear becoming something again in London, and I've always tried to avoid words like resurgence or this sort of stuff, because I realised what I think it was, and this is goes off into a whole thing we could talk about another for hours about, but I think it was bringing back to what should have always been before AIDS crisis, like a whole kind of generation of makers and hair people and people who buy the clothes and all this kind of culture of fashion that was kind of wiped out
right
in London and also in New York. So I think it's just, so what's been happening recently in London is bringing back what should always have been there. And I realised that, and I've been buying from young designers just all the time because it's just so exciting to see this work. And I realised that if I didn't donate this stuff, then it could be that piece of history was never marked or never actually... Never told. This was all pre-internet as well. And actually, the thing we know about internet is that we think everything's on the internet, but of course it's not. And so, yeah, it was really important for me to give the clothes to the V&A.
I also think it's really important, something that you've done, just quickly before we talk about the book, that you've done so well, is to champion unknown you know, designers literally straight from their college or degree shows and really sort of stick with them. Because I feel like Craig Green, I first heard about through you, you know, really early on. Yeah. I remember that blue kind of, well, it wasn't denim, it was kind of like a light blue jacket you had, really from his first collection or whatever. And I remember, I remember then I went and got one and kind of followed him too. And all the way through to him being in DSM and then, you know, getting bigger and bigger over the
years. DSM?
Dover Street Market.
Dover Street Market.
But also people like Molly Goddard.
You both came in quick then, like it was a game show.
Like a quiz show.
Dover Street Market.
Yeah. Fashion quiz show. No, but also people like Molly Goddard, like you've, and like you mentioned Wales Bonner, like you've really been there. A bit like Russell and I have always been so obsessed with emerging artists, which I know you are too. But I feel like people sometimes don't link the two, because to me, it's all these creative thinkers rising at the same time.
Yeah, and it's the most interesting thing to me. And I also think as well, it's to do with the kind of difference between fashion and fashion industry. And I think often when people talk about fashion, they just talk about luxury fashion, which is fine and interesting, but it's not everything. And I think it's the same with art and art industry. And there's the presumption that everything about art is like auction houses or the big, big, big galleries. And actually there's so much else that is just as interesting and maybe way more interesting. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Well, let's get a brief synopsis of your life. Charlie Portie is born in Peterborough in 1973.
Daventry, actually.
Where's that? Daventry, is that near Peterborough?
It's, well, I mean, it's kind of, it's, no. I mean, it's like level pegging. It's like Daventry is like right in the heart of the country. Like you pretty much, you can't go
Why does Wikipedia say Peterborough?
No idea. I live near Peterborough. I used to work in Arprice at Peterborough.
Did you, Arprice?
I did, yeah.
Oh, I loved Arprice. Arprice was like God to me. It was like my church.
Arprice had the best red counter that it was really high, so you felt really important on this big red counter.
God, I love
it. But the Arprice in Peterborough is incredible because it was there was a buyer there who was I worked every Christmas for 4 or 5 years, and it was right in the heart of a period I loved of like 91, 92, so everything coming out of Seattle on Sub Pop and all that sort of stuff. And there was a buyer there that was buying the most radical 7 inches and this proper incredible music. And there was also all these people that wanted just Shakin' Stevens and Cliff Richards. And it was this like a weird juxtaposition of like this hardcore, like a green vinyl 7-inch that there was only like 10 copies made of somewhere. And then Shakey's Christmas album. And,
genius.
I was very happy.
I miss record shops.
What was that? What was your experiences with art and fashion growing up in Daventry?
So I didn't grow up in Daventry. That's where I was born. We lived in the Midlands forever. There's many places. But
Born in Daventry, Alprice in Peterborough, and then the rest of the time somewhere else. Okay.
But my parents are both artists, and they met at the Slade in the 60s, and they're still practicing now.
What do they do? What's their art?
So my mum works in oil, and my dad works in watercolour, and yeah, they have like a converted garage in their garden, and mum has one half and dad has the other half. And
that's so cool.
Yeah, and mum is very focused on like working straight at that moment with whatever's there. And dad is more at the moment working from his mind.
From memory, or is it more abstract?
More abstract. At the moment, it's weird. They've kind of had the real kind of creative resurgence in that they're both in their 70s, and their work has gone really wild, and it's really exciting to see it go really wild.
You live with their work as well, right? I've seen you post it on Instagram.
Yeah. There's a painting by my mum behind me. That's actually from a few years ago. So it's kind of she's gone wilder and wilder, but. Yeah, these photos. She mum also obsessively takes photos.
Oh wow!
Like at night on her iPhone, and she goes around doing kind of real close-ups of books or corners of things or bits of paper, like super close-up. But they both work every day. Like they can't not work. They feel weird if they haven't worked. So. With growing up with them, it was just a constant practice. It was just something that was completely always part of our lives.
So did you ever think you would be an artist yourself?
Or no,
did
never,
you sort of
never.
Go to fashion as a place to express yourself in your own way?
No, never. And I've got three sisters and none of us have been artists. But there was never that question or never any that, you know, it was, if we wanted to, I'm sure we could have done. No, I always knew I wanted to be a writer. It was always clear to me. I knew that from reading Smash Hits and The Face. It was, you know, I used to read every single word of Smash Hits down to the editorial list, which they always hid jokes in. It was like, oh my God, defining the joke would be like the kind of this kind of fortnightly pleasure. And no, I always knew I wanted to write. And then, but fashion, I was just obsessed with. And we came down to London a lot. Because they met in London and they loved it, and they, you know, they moved to the countryside, but they always wanted to visit. And so I just start going to Camden Market or to Kensington Market,
right.
Or to Boy, or, you know, and
Boy London, yeah.
Boy London, yeah, and just buying things. And there was a stall in Kensington Market called Sign of the Times, which was the most incredible stall. Kensington Market was actually a precursor to Dover Street Market. I think they were by Kensington Market. It was an indoor market. It's all these kind of indoor stalls. And Sign of the Times was a stall that sold kind of clubwear and like young fashion. Mm. But it also sold mixtapes, and it had all the flyers for that weekend's clubs, because obviously there was no social media, and the place you went to find out what clubs were on was Sign of the Times. And I'd go and like they were free, but I'd go and just pick them all of them and decorate my bedroom with these flyers. And
I did that.
Yes,
I did that.
Yeah.
I didn't know half of what they were. I just liked the images and the ephemera.
Exactly.
Something going on outside. I probably was about 13, 14 on my bedroom in Essex. Not old enough to go, but just having them as like something to another world.
Totally. Knowing that something was going on. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was totally it. And that was it with fashion with me, knowing something was going on and that there were people who were thinking like how I was thinking.
Yeah.
And they had a £5 bargain bin in Sign of the Times, so I'd always go and rummage and get a t-shirt, obviously, which I kind of knew what was going on, but pretended I didn't.
With egg on there was egg all over it.
No. I got a £5 bootleg t-shirt of the Superdrug logo, which I just wore around, obviously pretending not knowing I knew what it meant. There was this t-shirt I had by this label called Big Jesus Trash Can that had this picture of Jesus on it, surrounded by angels with gas masks that I absolutely adored.
Quite Banksy-esque, doesn't it?
It was always exactly that thing about knowing that there were people who thought the same way that I did.
Mm. So you went to study fashion journalism, but couldn't.
Oh yeah, I couldn't afford it.
To get into Central St. Martin. Yeah. So you then became a researcher for the Daily Express in the mid 90s.
Yeah, I did. The paper that I always see, always kind of like, I worked at the Daily Express, and then go into some thing like it wasn't as bad then as it is now. And it was before the internet just, and so I spent a year and a half learning how to do research, like proper research, and working my way up there and learn a lot of things. And I think I was a lot better off learning that kind of hack stuff,
right,
the nuts and bolts of writing, than if I'd gone to study on the fashion journalism MA. I'm not sure there was actually that much more in the end that I would have learned.
No.
There.
Did you always find it quite easy to express the way you feel, like on in the written word? Because like Russ and I wrote our book during the lockdown, and we both kind of struggled initially because we were like, why are we allowed to write, sort of thing? Like you have to sort of give yourself permission or something. Yeah. Like, has it always been something that came naturally?
But that's the beauty of your book, is that it just sounds like you talking.
Yeah.
And that's what writing should be. I think the kind of when someone thinks you need to write like something else, that's when it all goes wrong.
Right.
Smash Hits really was the most phenomenal magazine in the mid 90s. And like so many important people wrote for Smash Hits, like Neil Tennant from the Pet Shop Boys.
Yeah, totally.
He started out at Smash Hits. Yeah.
No way.
He was the editor, wasn't he?
No.
I don't think he was the editor. I think he was like,
contributor.
Yeah. The sense of humor of that magazine, it was so sharp, even though they were talking about Wham or whatever, like the language of it, the secret jokes, the in jokes, the way they, and it was that thing of like using as few words as possible to say the driest, sharpest joke. Like it was extraordinary. I was so lucky to grow up with Smash Hits. Like it really taught me what you could, how playful you could be with words, and the placement of words, and also the brevity of words. I've always enjoyed it. I really enjoy writing. I don't find it a pain at all.
So you're a leading voice in fashion, and you've been a documenter of fashion for many years. Some of your contributions have been to Esquire, GQ, Fantastic Man, ID, The Face, where you went under a pseudonym. What was your pseudonym, and why did you need that?
My pseudonym was Toby Reynolds, which is my middle name and my mum's maiden name. And it was because I was then working at rival publication house, Nat Mags, working on Esquire. And my friends worked at The Face, and it actually was the first time I wrote. So basically, after The Express, I kind of started doing arts journalism with an S, because I presumed that that's what I would do, and I presumed that would be the easy thing to do. And also as a gay kid, that was kind of the kind of easiest way into papers as well. And I hated arts journalism with an S. I hated it. I really hated writing about, and I just presumed it would be the thing that would come so easily to me, but I really realized that, like, I don't care what anyone else thinks. And I think to actually be an arts journalist or an art journalist, you have to have some sort of like zeal to convince people in some way of what you like, or in music journalism as well. I was doing music journalism, and I was like, why am I trying to convince people of
like
this stuff?
Event.
Like, I love it. Yeah, exactly. And I don't care. It's like, I like it.
It's enough for you. Yeah.
It's enough for me. And all I care about is the fact that I really like what I really like. And I also hated in art journalism, I hated the way that the artist was expected to leave the room and then the critic turn up and, can I swear on talk?
Big time.
Piss all over it, like, you know, that expected thing of like the artist leaves and the critic turns up, and I really hated the relationship in arts journalism. This is just really personal. I'm not decrying all arts journalism. Obviously, I read it regularly, but I didn't like the space it was in. That's why it's so interesting to me that I've now come back around to write a book about artists, because it's so. It's been so nice to find a way to write about artists which feels different from a kind of journalistic relationship.
Yeah, when it comes to fashion, didn't you get banned from some fashion shows for writing scathing reviews? Wasn't there a group of you? So what happened there? There was a group of you that weren't allowed to review fashion shows. You were so mean.
There are different brands that I've been banned from for different lengths of time. But the Face piece was the first time I wrote about fashion, and that's what then led me to get a job in as a fashion editor, because I could just say, hey, look, this is actually me, this Toby Reynolds. I actually wrote this, and that's how I moved into fashion. But I was banned from Balenciaga really early on, because I tried to I thought I was being really nice. Like, they did these amazing cagoules that had like these really kind of droopy teardrop shapes. Mm. I can't remember what word I used to describe them, but I thought I was being really complimentary, but they were absolutely livid with the description. I was like, oh, okay, sorry. And then more permanently, I was permanently completely banned from Dolce & Gabbana, because they just really didn't like the fact that I said what I thought, and just completely, no, I'm not allowed. But it just meant that every Sunday in Milan during the menswear shows, it meant I got to go and have a nice lunch rather than sit and watch Dolce & Gabbana. So, you know, I was happy.
Finally. You have to be impartial as a kind of brand critic. How can they be like, we only want nice things said about us, so everybody said bad stuff can't come in?
No, but that's the difference. That's why I found fashion criticism interesting, because the thing about fashion criticism is that it takes place in private spaces. Like, you have to be invited into a fashion show. Whereas an art show, a film, an album, they're public events, right? I mean, you pay for them, but you have to pay to get a ticket, but anyone can go and see them. Mm. And there's something fascinating to me about being asked into this private space to write about a public, more and more people can watch live stream, but it's still not the same thing. Like, a public could never experience sitting on a front row, and I found it fascinating to go into these private spaces and to try and write as truthfully about them as possible. It was a very different experience. And also the other thing about fashion show writing as well was that, like, I realised really quite early on that, like, if I was to review, say, the Prada show with the sunrise jumpers,
the
review appears, that was in June, the collection wouldn't go in the shops for, like, till 6 months in January. The shop might, you know, the store, the brand really only ever makes like 10% of what's on the catwalk. Out of that 10% of stuff on the catwalk, there might be two things that I may have mentioned, and there'd be one person somewhere in the world who may have read the review, may eventually buy the piece that I wrote about 6 months before. So there's no direct link, whereas in art journalism, you kind of want people to go and see the art show or to see the film. Or so I really realised that what I was doing was writing about something very different than criticism in a kind of straightforward way,
if
that makes any sense.
It's all these, like, steps removed, isn't it?
Exactly. And also it's writing about sociological stuff, or, you know, political stuff, or all sorts of stuff, or also just making some cheap jokes. I don't know. It's like, I really like the space it
smash hits
provided
jokes.
To. Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
I remember seeing you outside of the Marnie show in Milan, and just thinking how crazy the whole thing was. Like, everyone was like, everyone turns up in these really mental outfits because so many people are trying to, like, have their photo taken by the on-street photographer, who's like almost like a kind of paparazzi in a tree or something. And they're all there and everyone's performing. And it was one of the most unique experiences I've ever had, going to that whole week in Milan. It was wild.
It was tough. And the thing with also the other thing I realized with it as well is that, like, there's something incredible about catwalk shows which to me, like, relates back to processions and how processions through history have been these things that people congregate to, and you know, processions play such a role in societies, and there's something processional about watching someone walk up and down in front of you. Because it's that thing of, like, oh, well, catwalk shows last and all this sort of stuff, because that, you know, there really is no clear reason why they should exist. But then if you said to most people, oh, do you want to sit front row at a fashion show? They'd be like, yeah. It's so, you know, desperate to do it. Like, it has this weird pull. And there is something really kind of addictive about watching them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've written this book, and it's called What Artists Wear. Yeah. And I have to tell you, Charlie, I have actually devoured this in one sitting, more or less.
Wow.
I've got up to page, it's 300 and something pages. I got to page 300 and fell asleep last night, and then I've read the rest today, and I think it's fucking brilliant. I absolutely, absolutely love it, because it goes so detailed, but it's so easy to read, and there's so much stuff about artists in there that I love, that I didn't know, that I'm just completely obsessed with. I've found out so many fun facts. I've found out so many references. I've understood so many things before that I hadn't really understood.
Yeah.
Congratulations. It's just fucking beautiful. But so for everyone listening, it's called What Artists Wear. Why did you choose What Artists Wear? Why was it not what, like, pop stars wear? Why was it not what politicians wear? Why was it What Artists Wear as a book?
That actually revealed itself to me as I was writing it. Like, the book started because I wrote a tiny little piece in the FT in like 2015, when there was the Agnes Martin show at Tate Modern, and at the same time the Barbara Hepworth show at Tate Britain. And there was a photo, which is actually in the book, of Agnes Martin at work in a studio in 1960. And,
which inspired you, that image inspired you to write the book.
That image inspired me because, and it's on page 65, And basically, I saw it and I thought, oh, she looks like she's wearing Craig Green.
Yeah.
Who's this young...
Yeah,
quilted.
Yeah.
Quilted, and it's boxy. And Craig is this young London designer who everything he does starts from a workwear jacket, like this humble shape. And I was like, she looks like she's wearing Craig Green. And it completely captivated me. And it kind of threw me down one of those whole rabbit holes of, like, time collapsing and then being now and now being then. And it just really got me thinking about artist clothing, and at the same time Margaret Howell had done some pieces for the Barbara Hepworth show, so I just wrote this little piece, and it triggered the book. And to answer your question, the thing about what artists wear, which is different from what anyone else wears, is that so an artist for are talked about for their style, right? A lot, and particularly by the fashion industry and by people who like fashion. But I always thought there was something more than just saying, oh, I like how David Hockney dresses, I want to dress like David Hockney, or a fashion brand saying, we think we can sell more clothes if we do a collection that looks like David Hockney. Mm. There always seemed like something else was going on. And I realised as I was writing it that actually what it is that artists are really amazing way to actually study clothing in general, because most of us in most jobs have at some point to dress a certain way for that job. So in the kind of most basic sense, it's to wear a suit or something formal for work. Mm-hmm. And even in like lockdown times when everyone's at home and not wearing a suit, there's still that sense of you have to wear something a bit smarter for a Zoom meeting. And what that does is that kind of muddies the water of the language of dressing, because you're having to dress in a certain way to for work or to please people or, you know, whatever. And I realised that actually artists don't have to do that, because so much of their work is studio based and hidden away and is about no one but themselves and trying to make their work happen. And so it was a way to actually really look at the language of clothing itself. And then also realizing that since I tag it to 1913, there may be there's something else as well, when Sonia Delaunay made this dress called the simultaneous dress, and this time when a garment became art. Because until that point, art was a sculpture or a work on canvas. And suddenly in the 20th century, art explodes and everything can become art.
So what, was she a moving canvas or something? Is that she saw here? Or?
So basically she made a dress that, and the dress was art.
Right.
And so basically it's...
She didn't wear it then anywhere.
I guess she did. I need to do more research on wanting to know that. But it's this fact that clothing could then be art. And then it, as the decades have gone on, and performance art, video art, photography, digital art, the artist is at the centre often of the work, and so therefore the clothing they're wearing is at the centre of the work.
Yeah,
and the artist is considering everything about how they appear in that work, including their clothing. So therefore there's also artists themselves are using the language of clothing that we understand. It's this other thing as well, is that like we all understand the language of clothing, even though we might not think we do. We're all experts at it to the highest degree. Yeah. So when you walk down the street, you understand what about someone approaching you just from their clothes. So we're all experts at clothing.
You adjust your body language by what someone's wearing around you, I think you said.
Exactly.
I found really fascinating the psychology of that, about like there's a coded quality to what someone's wearing that makes you go, oh, they look threatening, or they look fine, or I'm happy right. with that, or they're interested. There's an instant like synaptic connection. Yeah. You go, okay, I know what this is. I'm comfortable or I'm not comfortable
right.
with this.
And it sometimes is really blatant, like if a policeman walks down the street.
Uniform, yeah.
A uniform person, but also it's we're all actually expert at even like subtler differences, like and so therefore artists are using our expertness to make work. Like I emailed with Sarah Lucas for the book, and Sarah talked about how she thinks that people that the clothing kind of stands in for her in some way, and also about the universality of the clothing. So when she uses the tights and the bunny sculptures, or there's a really early work where she puts a razor blade in the front of some Doc Martens, we understand what she means by the work because we understand what a pair of Doc Martin boots means. Yeah. Like we understand about their toughness and, you know, like...
The patriarchy of it, I guess. Or
yeah, exactly, yeah.
And also the steel toe caps and stuff like that. It's kind of like, you know... They have a strength to them, don't they?
So we talked about Agnes Martin. What I found fascinating, which you highlight in the book, is this image of her in a quilted kind of grid work, trouser suit, separate pieces, and then her hair is plaited. But Agnes Martin is known for the grid. That's what she's famous
right.
for. But suddenly she's wearing clothing that looks like a grid.
That looks like the grid, and the hair is a grid. Yeah, it's an absolute... And I realised that just by looking at the photo, and it's like, oh my God, it's all a grid. And that was around the time when she was first starting the grid. The picture has her with a kind of ruler in her hand, and it's when she'd moved to New York for the first. She lived in New York for 13 years before she realised she couldn't live in the city. It wasn't for her, and she'd cut her hair off and disappeared for 18 months, and no one knew where she was. And then she reemerged with short hair in New Mexico. But yeah, all this, the grid of the clothing and the grid of the canvases, like, it's all there, like these kind of visual clues.
Yeah, and you've got on the cover, you have this amazing tailored suit that was worn by Georgia O'Keeffe.
Yeah.
Which, why did you choose that for the cover? It's amazing, because I thought it was Joseph Boy's, the felt suit.
Right, yeah.
That's what I recognised in it.
Yeah, the suit, I wish I could take credit for it. That was Penguin, the design department, who were like, suggested it, but I was really, really thrilled with their suggestion, because we knew we wanted an object rather than a person, so that it couldn't be connected with one artist.
Yeah,
and we knew we wanted to be kind of not readable by gender, and I like how this kind of plays with gender, because it looks like one of Joseph Boy's suits, but it's actually a tailor-made suit. Made for I think she was 93 when she, I have to check what I think, but a woman in her 90s, like, so a human that you wouldn't normally be expecting to be ordering bespoke suits from a New York tailor. Mm. And so we loved how completely already from the beginning the suit just kind of throws all these assumptions. And because tailoring forms a really important, I start with tailoring because I kind of feel that to deal with any clothing, you have to deal with tailoring to begin with, because it holds such a weird hold on the language of clothing, particularly to do with power. And in the end, so much of art is to do with addressing power or looking at power, who has the power, who doesn't have the power.
Yeah.
So
there's so many women in this book as well, that you cover so many female artists. But when you talk about the clothing, so much of their clothing is men's clothing. So many female artists have bought men's clothing and appropriated it themselves, but it's the suit was never, it was always designed for the man, from the military, where women were not allowed. And so women have had to kind of appropriate the patriarchy to then find their own style. And I love the fact that you have so many female artists in this, but it fascinated me that how many of them have appropriated menswear for themselves.
Right. Yeah. And also, That thing of, like, it's actually menswear, but it actually is for all human bodies, but it looks like it's menswear. An artist that I absolutely adore, Anne Truitt, I spoke with her daughter, and Alexandra said that her mum couldn't wear the women's wear at the time to do the work. She was an artist working in the 60s, 70s, 80s, I think, The women's wear at the time would have meant that she couldn't lift her arm up, because everything was too constricted. Like, she couldn't do the physical labor of making art. And actually, what artists needed were clothes that they could do physical labor in, which was assumed at that time to be the men's role. So they had to wear what was considered menswear.
There is something really interesting in that as well, when you think about artists and clothes, is like the practicality of it. You know, if you think of someone like Phyllida de Barlow in her studio, you know, you got surrounded by giant sculptures or cement or scrim and all these materials and woodworking and all that stuff. The actual reality of having to make something, you know, and get your clothes covered in paint, which you talk about as well. And, you know, versus what you begin the book out with the suits. Can you speak a bit about that, kind of the informal kind of, the practicalities and the freedoms that are needed in the clothes.
Right, yeah. So I do a chapter on paint on clothing.
Yes.
Because I'm a total mess, so like I love paint on clothing. Like I like dirty clothes. And Phyllida Barlow, I was lucky enough to be allowed to use image stills from a film by Cosima Spender, which was the Phyllida's RA show. In 2019, it was playing in the entrance to that, and it followed Phyllida on a day in her studio, and the physicality of a day, like the constant picking up a plank of wood, moving it to a pot of paint, slapping some paint on it, going over to the next, like, and there's this one amazing part where she's made this incredible sculpture. It's like a kind of spherical bits, some planks of wood, I don't know what it is, but it's like this amazing work. And she's just got it on a bench. And you just see her kind of smiling like a child and just kind of pushing it off the bench. And she throws the thing on the floor. And then when it gets on the floor, she then pulls it apart, this broken sculpture. She pulls it apart to see what else it can be.
Mm.
And it's this incredible kind of endless, kind of restless desire to see what something can be. And she does it all the time in this wax jacket that's just absolutely encrusted in paint and can almost be like a work in itself.
There's also something many people don't know about the art making process is a lot of artists do not have great heating and they're freezing cold.
Freezing.
And it's almost like battling the elements. And I think the realities of like sitting in an exhibition when you see a finished work on the wall, even if it's a Phyllida Barlow sculpture, it still becomes this kind of rare, hallowed space, a bit like a catwalk show, you know, where everything suddenly, all the chaos is totally distilled into this perfect, elegant, high-end kind of moment. But the reality is they often, and some younger artists can't even afford to like have, you know, the heating on or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, and I find that fascinating because Phyllida's wearing a scarf, kind of like tartan, like Scottish scarf or something. But, you know, I love that whole element of clothing and the reality.
Yeah. And isn't that fascinating? It's something I think about a lot as well, that thing, experience of being in a gallery and you know, someone, say a work of art is like, $4,000 or something, and some people are like, you know, why is that? And it's like, wait, so the gallery takes 50%, so that's $2,000 that might pay for like their studio rent and their mortgage, maybe for a month, maybe some
but then they have to pay tax,
but
on
like,
it as well, don't
tax as well, exactly. Yeah, so actually, like, they're barely making any money, like, they're barely getting by, and the realities of making art are it's shocking.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
But versus that, so you've got that kind of practical side. But then the thing that's always, the reason I love clothes is because of this idea of transformation and the way it's almost like armor, like you can put something on and become something else, or parts of yourself can be expressed through what you choose to wear. And if you think of a really kind of cliche in a way now, because everyone knows it so obviously, but someone like Frida Kahlo, or if you even go back to Joseph Beuys, like this idea of how clothes can have a charged power and like kind of healing power or meaning. Do you know what I mean? Like this whole transformation side of it.
Yeah.
All.
There's an incredible image of Frida Kahlo in the book of 1926 where she's dressed in a suit and she's alongside all her female relatives who are all in dresses. And this was after she'd had the tram accident and everything, collarbone and everything had been shattered. But she's so like present and so like, and you just think at the time
staring at the camera. Really totally the intention. Shocking. Yeah. And it was just before she met Diego. And just before the whirlwind of her life went on another whirlwind, and then she then wore traditional dress when she was with Diego because that's what Diego liked her to wear, and then I have in the book this painting that's in MoMA, which is self-portrait with cropped hair, I think it's called, where she's sat in a suit which is presumed to be Diego's suit, with all of her long hair cut off around her, and they've just separated. And it's this real, like, absolute fuck you of, like, you know, I'm wearing Dior suit and I've cut the hair that you love, I've cut it off. But then they soon got back together and then she returned again to the traditional Mexican dress.
Traditional dress. So there's so many amazing images you have in the book. There's an image of Louise Bourgeois, who's at 12 years old, wearing Chanel.
Right.
And she's like, yeah. And I saw that. I was like, what? She's 12 and they've dressed her in Chanel. So she's obviously come. I didn't realize how privileged Louise Bourgeois' life was, but I guess the surname gives it away.
Right.
Because that itself is the most bourgeois name. And all this time, I'd never really thought about it, but it's literally just labeled her
Louise
Bourgeois.
House.
I think that's also what informed a lot of her work, though, Ross, is that whole patriarchy, you know, that the home, this kind of very expensive house she grew up in and all the expectations. I mean, and thinking about transformation as well, like later in her life in 75, she stood outside wearing a sculpture.
Right.
You know, that amazing sculpture with the lumpy, you know, sculpture that she actually wears and she becomes...
It looks like lava, yeah.
Oh, it's just amazing.
Yeah,
you talk about precursor to kind of Björk. And,
right. Yeah, and you talk about her friendship with Helmut Lang in her later years, and he used to gift her clothes and she'd gift him art, and they had like a friendship with each other that was really deep.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, I mean, those years I'd be going to New York to the shows, and I hadn't met Helmut by then, but like just going to Helmut's shop and there'll be a Louise Bourgeois work in the shop, and it's just like, oh my god, buy these.
Oh, products. Really?
Yeah, there was always art, her art was in the shop. He always had Jenny, his shop was incredible. He had Jenny Holzer, he had Jenny Holzer textworks going down
on ticker tapes, like,
the rails were all these kind of black monoliths that the clothes were hidden behind, and then these Jenny Holzers going down the edge of them. It was just the most unbelievable shot, like, but it was that thing of that incredible thing of like inquisitive minds feeding off each other, like Helmut's designs feeding off what Louise and Jenny were doing, I've got in the book the page from Louise's diary when she first met Helmut, and she was in her 80s then or 90s, and she writes the H of Helmut with like over the lines with the kind of hooks on the H, like a teenager would about their first love, and you can see that she was really charmed by him, and the creative relationship that kind of fed her later years, these really fertile years of working for her. Like the book started, the research and the writing of the book started by spending a couple of days at Louise's house in New York. It's a private foundation. No, you can't go as the public. They always, whenever I mention it, they say, please say you can't go, because they can't go with anyone knocking on the door. But there's a house next door, which is where all the archive is kept, and then you go through these doors that have been cut through to Louise's house that's been preserved exactly as it was when she died, and there were these two rails of clothing, like completely like no airs and graces at all. One was in the basement under some stairs, propped up under some plastic boxes, and then the other one was in this tiny, tiny galley kitchen right by this like industrial strength like chef's gas burner, and like these extraordinary clothes like within fat spitting distance, and the way that she clearly loved clothes because they were so much a part of her life, but also she didn't deify them as well, like they were worn, they were there to be worn, they weren't there to be worshipped, and the way that she wore pieces by Helmut Lang was to then give herself inspiration. It was like this kind of creative spark thing.
Didn't she have like a monkey jacket, a monkey wear fur jacket that then got shrunk at some point?
Right. So basically there's a really famous portrait which is in the book, which is by Mapplethorpe, where she is smiling, stood there in a monkey fur coat holding a sculpture of a massive cock, penis, not
a bird,
animal,
an actual piece,
and she stood there with this.
It looks like an ancient Greek sort of effigy,
ancient
like,
Greek phallus, and she's got this massive grin on her face, and there is a coat like it on the rail, but they were like, actually, we think there's another one, which a writer called Gary Andriano, an amazing, he was the Village Voice critic in the 70s and or the 80s, his writing is phenomenal. Semiotext did a compilation of his writings. You should read his criticism, it's incredible. So I emailed Gary to say, do you have the Mapplethorpe coat or is it the one in Louise's house? And he was like, yeah, I've got it. Someone put it in the wash, it shrunk. I just love this complete disregard for
our history.
exactly. You know, I it's complete, like, oh my god, like, you know, the lives they lived rather than, you know, kind of deifying their lives.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I really love in the book is this idea that art and fashion are somehow like, you know, there's a kind of kinship between the two. And when I first was hanging out in the art world, I remember certain artists would sort of almost look down on the fashion industry or even gallerists or whatever. But then I feel like in the last kind of 5-10 years, that division maybe is starting to become much more like everything's becoming much closer. And if you I think the reason is because of designers are now being seen as these kind of artists in their own right, and people are beginning to understand fashion in a way they never
collaborations between before. Artists and designers.
Yeah, but also the thing I like about the book is the friendships between the artists and the designers.
Right.
And the creatives like head to head. So you've got like our recent guest Rachel Feinstein with Marc Jacobs.
Right.
So you've got these kind of coming together of two minds. So even they're from different disciplines, they're still artists. Can you speak a bit about that and what you think that's
I think friendships is the most interesting place where fashion and art come together. And like, you're right. Like, for years, there's been this kind of weird sort of like, we kind of know each other, but we don't know each other. Like, almost like two gangs that are kind of like really want to become friends, but they, in the end,
West Side Story.
Yeah, exactly. and they have become closer recently because it has become such a thing within fashion for there to be fashion collaborations or also some designers claim that their work is art, though actually I'm much more on the side of Ray Kawakubo, who's the Comme des Garçons designer, who's like, no, it's not art. You know, she's a designer. It's a, if she was wanted to be an artist, then she'd be an artist. And but I actually think that the place it's most fertile and most interesting is when there are these friendships between a designer and an artist. And Rachel was amazing. I love talking with her, and she told about how she was in a real creative rut. She really was stuck, and she loved fashion, and she was good friends with lots of designers. And Marc Jacobs, the New York designer, asked if he could use one of her sculptures as the kind of set for her show. And she just said, like, oh, actually, I'd like to make you something new. And he was like, okay, the show's in 2 weeks. And so she had these 2 weeks of creating these unbelievable huge sets, kind of like theatre sets, but purposefully left unfinished. Like, and all the it's like these buildings and fountains and follies.
It's like a jaunty fountain, isn't there? But it's a bit gothic as well.
And they all look a bit tipsy. Everything looks a bit drunk and tumble down and huge. I mean, it was a huge like it was like a massive stage play, but like a stage play in Wembley Arena, like March which showing these vast halls, and the experience of creating from nothing this vast set freed her. It completely freed her, and it then led to sculptural works which she's now become known for. Like, there was an outdoor public commission in New York a couple of years afterwards, and one of those works is now at Chatsworth in the gardens in the UK, and
they all look like stage cutouts, don't they? Like the scenery for theatrical operas and
Exactly.
Very Baroque, very kind of fairy tale-esque.
Fairy tale, exactly.
Yeah, but adult fairy tale and a bit wrong and naughty and working on the fashion show Frida, and it was amazing to hear her talk about how working with fashion Frida up. So it wasn't about this kind of like, I don't understand who you are, you're over there. It was like, oh no, let's just get stuck in and do something. And
I always remember seeing Ann Collier in New York and Matthew Higgs. And every time I would bump into them, they were always with Raf Simons.
Right,
when he was at Calvin Klein. And I actually went over and said hi to him at one of those Rob Pruitt like fairs. You know, he does the Christmas fair or whatever. But, and I always remember thinking that was really cool because they seem to like really love each other. And
they're super fans.
They share ideas and, you know.
Yeah, but I think it also goes back to Matthew. So Matthew Higgs is the White Columns director and a super fan of art. And I think he also has a deep, deep love of New Order as well. Mm-hmm. And Raf loves New Order. There's all these kind of counterculture.
Bootleg counterculture, works.
Yeah, there's shared common ground and common interest as well as Raf's love of art. Like Raf is a well-known collector of art, and
how cool is Taboo as well. You have to.
Oh my god!
Because I mean, that is just one of the coolest bits of the whole book. Taboo, and that green suit, and oh my god, I love Taboo.
Taboo is like, if we're allowed to recommend guests, then please, Taboo is.
He's there. He's coming on.
We're planning it, and yes. Sent his new book from Karma, and we're all very
most
excited.
Divine company, like it's absolute heaven, and Taboo is this incredible artist who has been working since the 80s. And actually, he was part of the East Village counterculture club scene in New York, and he performed at Pyramid. He did drag. He did drag until I think the early mid 90s. Mm-hmm. He appeared at Wigstock and all these really important New York moments. But he also did the flyers as well. And right from the beginning, he had this like line which involved like psychedelic swirls and these letters that dance and this effervescence and this absolute love of
60s.
Life and creativity. Yeah. And actually he is part of my upbringing because he did the graphics for the Delight first album, Well Click, and all the singles that came off that. So Groovers in the Heart, Power of Love and Smile On. And I bought them all. I was obsessed with Delight. Who was the one before Pete Tong on Radio 1? I never remember his name, but like in the days of when you used to have to like press play and record to record off the radio. Like I remember the Friday before we went on a family holiday, I was just recording a new tape to listen on the drive to holiday, and he played this new record called Groovers in the Heart, and then the B-side, What is Love? And I just was sat in a car driving on holiday, so I'd have been 15 or 16, just like, what is this world? Like, absolutely obsessed. And then when I got the records and these graphics completely blew my mind, and I just painted spirals all over all my school notebooks and everything. But basically, Taboo was completely not recognised for years and years and years, and he still lives in the same fourth or fifth story walk
up. Five story up, like, isn't it? No lift.
Yeah. Proper like old like rent control New York, real New York, real East Village. But his work started selling about 4 or 5 years ago, and suddenly he's got the money to go into Gucci and be like, bag it up. Like, and he buys the most incredible clothes. I think his Instagram is Taboo. It's spelt with an extra B, so it's TABBOONYC. You can see his fabulous fashions daily on Instagram.
Yeah, he's done lots of videos and everything, him singing, lip syncing performing.
And he loves fashion, and he loves it as a creative expression. And he says that the it's always been the case. He talked about when he was young and when he first got. One of my absolute favorite quotes in the book. And he said, it always surprised me when I get to it. I always forget it's coming. So he talks about the first time he was allowed to buy clothes in the 60s. And he said, when it was time for me to pick out the clothes, that's exactly how he said it. Mm-hmm. When it was time for me to pick out the clothes, this was the mid-60s. We're talking psychedelia, little paisley shirts, striped pants, velour. I was like, girl, I was living for that shit. And that was him as a like little kid, and he said that it's always been the case that music, fashion, fed the creativity of the art, and the art feeds the fashion. It's all the same thing for him.
Yeah. And it also inspires other people and other artists. That's what I love about people like him. Right. I remember first hearing about him about 7 years ago from Elizabeth Clay, a sculptor who's with him at the gallery.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth's like a really good friend of his. I didn't really know him at all. But then I realized I did know him because he'd influenced so much of culture. And like so many other people have referenced him. You know, it's like, it's fascinating. I'm so happy he's getting his time.
Yeah. Exactly. There's so many amazing facts in this book. I want to reel off some facts for our listeners because it's incredible. But 1963, I didn't realise Pantone started, which is the benchmark for colours, henceforth, forever. You gave me that fact. Thank you. In 1909 Paris, if a woman wanted to wear trousers, they had to ask the permission of the police.
Yes. And it was only repealed in 2013.
That's
so
right.
So technically, it was illegal. So if you were identified as female in Paris up until 2013, it was illegal for you to be wearing trousers. And it was connected to the sans-culottes movement of the revolution. Please don't ask me more questions.
Is that like a Les Miserables thing where they were like,
something, I think, because I think there were female protesters who wanted to join the protests and they were banned from wearing culottes, I think. I'm not quite sure. But it was really interesting to me when I was...
It's like, preposterous.
the book, that there was a couple of rules guiding the book, and one of which was, because I was going to jumble up the photos, all the photography needed to look kind of from a time when photos didn't have to be like take 5 minutes to. So apart from Louise Bourgeois's childhood photos, everything is kind of like post Second World War. Mm. So I was looking at this kind of time where you presume when you think about it, like, oh yeah, everyone's got rights, everything's fine. And then when you actually look at like, wait, when did actually women get the right to vote in places like France? And what was the art that was happening at that time? And I'm now going to have to flick through the book to find the actual date because it's not high on my mind. But it's like way later than you think it was that women got the vote in... it wasn't until 1944 that women were granted the right to vote. Not that long ago. So then you think about the art that's being made in Paris and who gets to make the art and how are women seen in that art. And I then thought, oh, well, did Frida Kahlo have the right to vote? And you then start thinking about the conditions in which people made their work or even weren't able to make their work. And also then when there are alleged rights, still people aren't able to make the art they want to make, like women in America and also people of colour in America in the 20th century, especially like 60s, 70s. And really that being one of the real fuels for performance art, because these artists weren't allowed to make art in the spaces where art was deemed accepted, like galleries or institutions. Mm. And so these artists had to find ways of making art and making art in ways that almost like kind of went, they were allowed to do it, that they couldn't, hadn't got words to describe what they were doing. Like the first performance artist didn't say, oh yeah, I'm a performance artist. They just were trying to do something. And then for them, the clothes they wore, they became central to their work. And it's that thing of like, you have to look at that history to understand more about actually what it is that an artist making, or who gets to make art, who doesn't get to make art.
And also, I guess, what they're wearing, because, you know, that's also a response
to
social situations of that time. Because it's a way of communicating, isn't it? If you think of Frida, she's saying something through those images, through the clothes that she wore.
Right.
She actually died 2 years before the women were allowed to vote in Mexico as well, so she never got that chance. Another fact was Joseph Beuys, he is like iconic for his hats, but he had a metal plate in his head, so his head would get cold. So the hat was actually a precaution against the cold.
Precaution, yes. So it was I thought you were going to say the fact about him was that his nickname was Josie.
Oh, I didn't know that, no. No, it's just the fact that I didn't realise he had a metal plate in his head, and that was where the hats come from.
It had actual practical reason. The plane crash is part of his mythology because he says that he was it saved by wolves? I can't remember the mythology now, but it became part of his story that something about the plane crash. But he definitely was in the German army and definitely crashed his plane and had a metal plate in his head and needed these felt hats to protect him. And then from that, he built this wardrobe of the fisherman's jacket, the white shirt, the Levi jeans. That he then said had got this shamanistic power and that the clothes could stand in for him.
I still love all that. I love all that. It's such a genius kind of, I don't know, it's brilliant.
Talking about jeans. I was going to say, talking about jeans, Andy Warhol wore denim under his tux when he went to the White House to meet the president because he was obsessed with denim jeans, which is so like Americana denim and the epitome of Andy Warhol. But he wore denim underneath a tux when he met the president.
Yeah, that was one of my favourite facts. And actually, There was that Warhol biography that came out last year, and the thing that I was most panicked about before when it came out was like, did he get the jeans under tuxedo fats? And obviously, who could give a damn about that? He's got other things to think about. But like, I was like, please don't have heard that story.
It's amazing. Yeah,
Bob Colicello, who was the editor of Interview magazine, who was kind of Warhol's kind of traveling companion for 13 years. Yeah, he just told me this story. I was like, oh yeah, and he was invited to the White House. It was the Ford White House. It was a dinner for the Shah of Iran, and Andy found the tuxedo itchy, so he wore denim jeans under the tuxedo to meet the man who at the time Amnesty International then said was like one of the worst violators of human rights in the world. Like, it's this complete like, oh my god, what is going on? Like,
that's good. He sort of showed some sort of internal disrespect to him at that point by wearing the jeans. One more fact before Rob's got a question, but I didn't realize that Yayo Kusama had a fashion label for a while that was like a consignment in like Debenhams or something where you could buy Kusama clothing.
Yeah.
What happened? Have you ever seen any of that clothing in real life?
Never seen any of it. It was in Bloomingdale's. It's such a... And that's also another thing that I found fascinating doing the book was that thing of presumed histories and what we presume we know.
Yeah.
I wrote the book mostly in the British Library and would spend the day going from book to book to book, and I found this old Kusama catalogue from an American show. I can't remember where it was, but it was a show in the 90s, way before Kusama became the kind of this kind of global celebrity that she is now. Mm. And it had all these amazing details in it that, because no one's found this book and put them in their own books, just aren't in any of the recent books about Kusama. And yeah, it got the press release that the... That she put out for the fashion label. Basically, she had a fashion label, and it kind of sounds like it really didn't work. But it sounds like she wanted it to be these kind of orgy clothes, which she'd been making for as performance art, because
the
she
bums cut out place
within
it?
New York. Yeah, huge holes in bums. But she hated sex as well, so it was also this kind of weird facing up to her fear and loathing of sex and the body And I think she wanted the fashion label to be that, and obviously Bloomingdale's kind of wanted just some tie dye and polka dots, and it folded very quickly. I couldn't find any actual images of it. One tie dye there's a picture of a tie dye T-shirt, but we couldn't find the original photo to put it in the book. It just was the black and white one in the other book. Right.
So. I always really liked her collaboration much more recently, but with Louis Vuitton when she did all
that. Right.
I thought it was really mental. It was because you start seeing them all around the world when I was traveling a lot with work, and you would see like collectors all holding these bags, and it just became like a kind of giant expanded, I don't know, painting or something. It was such a weird...
I don't know,
I really liked that whole era.
Yeah, that was a really good time of collaboration. That's when Marc Jacobs was at Louis Vuitton. And
exactly, yeah.
I was lucky. I didn't see the Kusama show. I can't even remember if there was an actual show for it, but I remember turning up to the venue, and the thing with fashion shows is you never know what it's going to be really until you turn up. And they had these huge balloons outside them. And I'm now completely brain frozen with the artist. I keep wanting to say Murakami, but it wasn't Murakami, the Japanese artist. Do I now cite it on Google? How often do you find people like freezing for names and then... have to like search and Google.
Never, ever. Everyone's always on top of everything.
You're the only person in the history of
in the history of it.
And we're going to let everybody know.
Do you know what? His name was Murakami. What am I talking about? Takeshi Murakami.
He did the multicolored Vuitton logo, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
The collaboration as well.
Yeah, Takeshi Murakami. Yeah, so basically, yeah.
We can leave that bit in then, just to show how right.
Yeah, exactly. Just so I was completely right. Yeah, so
how bitchy we are. Yeah, we're gonna ruin you. Would you possibly read a poem out of your book on page 256? Which at school, David Hockney was introduced to this poem by, which is by 17th century poet Robert Herrick, and it's called "Delight in Disorder," and it really struck a chord with me.
Right. So this is Delight in Disorder. A sweet disorder in the dress kindles in clothes a wantonness, a lawn about the shoulder thrown into a fine distraction, an erring lace which here and there enthralls the crimson stomacher, a cuff neglectful and therefore rebunds to flow confusedly, a winning wave deserving notes in the tempestuous petticoat, a careless shoestring in whose tie I see wild civility, do more bewitch me than when art is too precious in every part.
So you said that Hockney recognised, thank you for that, Hockney recognised himself in those words. In what way? How do we know that, and how did he use that throughout his work?
See, he still refers to this poem today. And for me, it was that thing of this idea of sweet disorder and wild civility, and this sense that, yeah, the title Delight in Disorder, like, I think so often there's this attempt to try and dress like Hockney, which usually means block colours put together in kind of a vivid way, like a yellow sweater with a blue pair of pants. But that's just wearing a yellow sweater with a blue pair of pants. And actually what Hockney does is he has this kind of gleeful imperfection about it all, and this kind of gleeful desire for this kind of wantonness of living. You know, it's that sense of what you wear kind of gives you this kind of energy and this kind of sense of creativity, and I think it really links with his work and links with the way he lives his life, this sense of like sweet disorder and the thing about him like always smoking and never giving up smoking, mm-hmm. like the wantonness and the civility, like that kind of sense of living life on his own terms for himself. And that incredible example he set in the 1960s, where he arrived in London from Bradford and was unashamedly out and proud and queer, at a time when it was illegal in the UK, and had absolutely no. It's so weird. You don't want to even say unashamedly, because that's like saying it like it's a negative. Like, he just was queer. And I was thinking about it a lot, and I realised that actually, you know, he was a working class lad from Bradford, and I realised that up until Hockney, the look of queer working classes was fetishized, because the look of queerness was set by those who had the ability to kind of live above society with wealth, like kind of Christopher Isherwood, or you know, all those kind of people from the 1920s and 30s who were romanticized, or that kind of that Merchant Ivory kind of look, you know, the kind of Morris, I always want to call it Maurice, but Morris, that, you know, those films in the 80s, or The Room with a View, that kind of foppish look, and that actually working classes were fetishized, and they are still fetishized today. Like the role of laborers are fetishized in
The plumber, the electrician,
exactly, yeah, yeah, it's hot,
yeah, it is, yeah, hot.
And it's hot, but the thing is that actually Hockney was this kind of first generation of working class queer humans who was like, no, I'm going to define queerness for myself. I'm not going to pay heed to this upper class look of queerness. I'm going to dress for myself, and he did it from day one, and I think that's what's really admirable about his style. It's not just the building blocks of colour. It's the intention and the meaning of it. Mm.
Before we go to the final questions, you were a Turner Prize judge, and Russell has been this year.
Yeah,
we bumped into each other on the street in Shoreditch recently, and I was like, "So, help! Give me some advice."
very, very different circumstances. Mm. I mean, I had the absolute good fortune to be a judge in a year when art was made, shown, and it was possible to actually go and visit art. So, yeah, you know, yeah. I don't know how you managed, and you know, it's because we were able to even meet each other. I think you posted on
everything's
Zoom.
None of
you ever met.
Nope.
Yeah.
Never.
And whereas we could like form this kind of
crew.
Yeah, exactly, and go to shows together and go see things. But incredible experience. Yeah, I loved it.
When you started writing this book, you were judging, right?
Yeah, it was. They coincided because you're asked like a little bit before, and then the kind of process of it. So it was exactly the same time, and I really found that being a Turner Prize judge helped me so much to learn how to look, and it was really that thing of like breaking time and breaking the fear of time, because I think I still had, at that point, a fear of video art or performance art based around like fear of like, oh, how long is it going to be? Am I going to be okay? Will I get bored? Will I got to be somewhere else? All that stuff that you go through. And also the thing of like when you go into a gallery and there's a video playing of like, oh, do I watch it? Do I not watch it? How long do I watch it for? Do I go look at, you know, all that sort of stuff which gets in the way of actually looking the work. And I realized that to be a judge, I had to be with the work. There was no two ways about it. I had to watch what they were doing. And it really helped me to relax into looking at art, which then helped me to relax into looking at all art, you know, art that was on a wall as well, like allegedly traditional art. And it really helped me to learn how to look, which then helped me to write the book. And it really was the most magic experience. Yeah.
And you timely finish the book with images of the winners, because
right.
It's an unusual year where all four nominees decided to form a collective.
Yeah, the
they were
decision.
Kind of like one artist. Yeah, and I always remember that evening because it was so interesting what everyone chose to wear.
Right.
In a sense, very contemporary clothes, but also like if you think of Tai Shani's kind of Tories out Perspex necklace that she was wearing, you know, it's a very contemporary sense of this idea of an artist trying to communicate a message in a very direct way that was meaningful because there was the election coming up and all of that stuff.
And Helen Kammett read the speech on behalf of all four of them wearing a bomber jacket and a single huge hoop earring and a black polo neck and in complete contrast to what you would expect someone to wear at a formal dinner, you know, the tailored suit or a dress or something, you know, it was wild and my deadline was actually the week, was it that week or the week before? So I kind of asked for an extension for 2 weeks because I kind of had an inkling that it would be a great place to end the book and I hadn't got another plan if it wasn't so. thankfully it turned out to be this amazing place to end because I really was so moved and inspired and excited by what those four artists did. That's Tai Shani, Lawrence Abu-Hamdan, Oscar Murillo, and Helen Kammack, and the seriousness of their decision and the seriousness of their work in that show, like that it was deeply exciting to me and kind of generative and makes me excited to go on and think more and I think it was a really incredible way for that whole kind of experience of doing the Turner Prize. Amazing way to end.
I think in many ways what they did was provoking thought and sort of taking action in a way and getting people to think about their own position in the world and what you believe in and what you would do to fight for what you believe in. Right. Just in that very simple act of them doing that, I think it's a very, I don't know, I think it provokes thought. And I think your book does that too. Like, I really am inspired by this book and I think people are going to love
it. When is it out, Charlie?
So it's out 27th of May.
Okay, great. So soon.
Yeah.
So very soon.
So many artists in here that have been on Talk Art as well, which is amazing. You've got Anthea Hamilton, Alvaro Barrington,
Louise Bourgeois, Georgia O'Keeffe, Frida Kahlo. they're all in there. You're like, what? So we ask every guest that comes on two very important questions. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, if you could have any work of art in the world to yourself, what would it be and why? But I just want to add that you grew up with art with your parents, but your husband is also an artist, Richard Porter, who's in a group show at the Modern Institute at the moment.
Right, yeah. So do I have to say one of Rich's works or do I get...
Well, it depends if Rich's going to listen to Talk Art or not, but...
And also, do I then like not have my parents' work because I have one of Rich's works? No, I think that means I get to live with them anyway, right?
You get all of them, yeah.
They're always here. Like, so the work I would steal one of the Wagon Stations by Andrea Zittel, and they're these incredible pods that you can sleep and live in, because I kind of think if I'm going to steal something, I need to actually like be able to live in it as well. And she has them... in her encampment, is that the right word? That sounds really
ranch.
Scary. It's kind of this space she has near Joshua Tree in California, and she's just like an absolute I absolutely adore her work. And yeah, so A Wagon Station by Andrea Zittel, please. Quite hard to steal though. It's quite a
are they not on wheels?
Big structure.
Not on wheels.
Have you actually been there?
No, I never have. And I really hope I get to go one day. I do actually eat all the time. I eat my breakfast and lunch from her bowls. She only ever eats out of bowls. Like, her work is about processes of living. And she shows with Sadie Coles in London. And Sadie had a little shop a couple of years ago that sold a bowl. So I eat eat out of her bowls all the time.
But that wagon relates to her apartment living, doesn't it? Wasn't she like when she first moved to, where was she, in New York? And then it was just so small and compact that she had literally had everything next to her bed.
Yeah, she worked in a gallery in New York and she lived in a 54 square foot apartment. So she turned that into A to Z East, that was called. Her place she lives now is A to Z West, which is a vast kind of space. But A to Z East was this tiny, tiny apartment. And it started her artist practice, which was looking at whether you can put rules on the way you live and actually find liberation through that to break through patriarchal systems.
Love.
The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
Blue.
Straight in. Prada blue or Marnie blue or grey green blue?
Cornflower blue.
Yes.
And it's cornflower season imminently, and I bought some cornflowers from Columbia Road from Lyndon, who I always buy my plants from. And
every time I see you, like on a Sunday, you've always got plants from Columbia Road.
Plants from Columbia Road.
Do you buy fresh plants every Sunday, like Elton John?
But, so, plants from Columbia Road. And it just came into flower, this gorgeous cornflower, and it's a white cornflower. It's not a blue cornflower. So I need to take my cornflower back.
And actually, that early workwear jacket by Craig Green was almost cornflower blue, wasn't
right.
it? Like that's the blue I was trying to describe earlier.
Yeah, I love it.
Tell me about your house quickly, because don't you live in concrete or something? About you renovating a house.
No, it wasn't me. I live in a 60s block, and I bought it off architects who bought their flat in the 90s when you could buy a flat for a pittance and they just stripped back the walls. So they stripped back the walls to the concrete that everyone's got. Just I've got the concrete and not the walls. So yeah, we live in this kind of concrete stripped back, no wall. The staircase is a drawbridge, but we've never actually pulled it up. But yeah, and there's a massive hole in the between the two floors that's got a big glass table on it that wheels out. It's this funny kind of
I remember it sounding really like experimental, and I was really impressed, and I wasn't sure whether you'd like overseen it all.
Have you had it photographed ever? Have you done a modern house or anything?
No. But the thing about it is that it's like, it's actually a really, really functional way of living, like in that kind of Andrea Zittel way. Like it really works, like the flow of how you move about in the house, which I find fascinating, because my nightmare is to be in a kind of Victorian terrace house, which is built for a stifling family of four, horrible, I like the idea of functionality within living, which is, again, the Andrea Zittel thingy bob.
I love that. I've just got to thank you as well. I've realized through my journey of being a super fan of David Robiliard that you are also, I think, a kindred spirit in being a super fan of David Robiliard. And there's an amazing section in there. You go through about five pages and some of the photographs I'd never seen of images of him and his work and his style. And I want to thank you for that, because and at some point I'm trying to do more for him and create something, and especially maybe get his poetry read properly in a proper collection of all of his prose and everything. I think would be something that I would.
When I saw that section, Russ, I was like, "Oh my god!"
Yeah, I just feel like we would have been all mates, or
exactly.
We'd all hang out. I absolutely love him.
Yeah, so much.
And also, we're not going to, we miss this, but I want people, if they do buy this book, which they need to buy this book, What Artists Wear by Charlie Porter, that there's this whole section on an artist called Lynn Hirschman, who I didn't know much about, who lived for 5 years as someone completely different called Roberta Brightmore. And she had one outfit, one wig, one cardigan, one dress. And she also had one jacket, but her jacket got stolen at some point. And she used to go
creepy meeting,
And she used to go and sit with a psychoanalyst as the character that she was playing for 5 years. And he didn't know that she was pretending to be someone else. Now, we haven't got time to talk about it, but everyone who reads this book, you need to read this story, because it blew my mind.
Yeah.
It sounds like it needs its own episode.
It needs a movie. There's a movie there.
And Lynn is still a practicing artist. And actually, anyone who's in New York, able to be in New York, there's a show of hers opening at the New Museum, a survey show at New Museum in June, I think it is.
Okay.
If anyone lucky enough to be in New York, please go and see the Lynn Hirschman Neeson show.
Wow.
And also, who took your author photo? Is it your husband?
My husband took it on my birthday at Towpath Cafe on the canal in
Hackney. I thought it was him. It's such a sweet photo of
him on
the back of the book. Also, everyone go out and buy this book. It's published by Penguin and it's out at the end of May. And honestly, it's extraordinary.
It's amazing.
And it's the kind of thing people are going to want to gift to other people because it's that good.
I've got,
I want to buy this.
It's so good. And also find an image of Francis Bacon's curtains. I'll leave you with that.
Exactly.
But yes, thank you so much for coming on, Charlie.
Thank you.
Yeah, for everybody listening, go to our @TalkUp page on Instagram. You can find images of everything we've been talking about. Charlie is also on Instagram. You are at
The Charlie Porter, which sounds like a really like grand thingy, but yeah.
Great. And then
at The Charlie Porter.
Get What Artists Wear by Charlie Porter, which is available now by the time this goes out. And we love you. Thanks for sticking with us, everyone.
For listening,
and
everyone.
See you
we'll
all
be
soon.
Back very soon.
Bye, Charlie.
Bye. Bye, Charlie.
Stick around.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.